push a record button.
Hey, how's it going? Hey, it's...
Oh, sorry, I interrupted you. Don't forget to push record.
And as you can hear, there's a voice in the sky right now. This is... I will push record. Welcome back. This is Daniel Mark, Nerd Roundup, DanielBMarkham.com. If you haven't been with Nerd Roundup before, basically the idea here is technology creation should be a joy. You should enjoy making tech. You should have fun with the people you work with. And as a way of sort of modeling the behavior we'd like to see, I've invited some nerd friends over once a week, and we sit down and look at nerd news of the week and just really try to get nothing useful done at all except for having a good time, telling jokes, and just sort of goofing off. And you should be able to do that at work. We succeed and perform as technology creators by relaxing through the work. And so it's important to be able to goof off. And today, I've got James Grinning. James Grinning. Greetings, my friend.
Greetings, Daniel. Thanks for having me over.
And I did push record, so we're we're on. Woo-hoo. Yes.
All right. You're a professional.
Yes. Do not try this at home, friends. Yes, it's like the MythBusters guys. They're always blow. You know, we really should blow some more stuff up here. I think it was funny because I visited Bob several years back, and we were doing some videos and. I said, Bob, we should do something more technical, which Bob is always technical. Bob's like, yeah, let's do something more technical. I'm like, okay, we'll build giant robots and make them battle. And it never really took off. I don't think he liked the giant robot idea, but I gave it a shot.
Well, giant robots, that could take some time.
Yeah, I guess it sort of depends what you mean by robot. You know, a car with a flamethrower could be a robot. So our first article, and this is sort of a bonus article, didn't ask anybody to review this, but I saw this morning, and it was just amazing to me. And this is, they're actually working on a sustained detonation wave. And I didn't know that there was a difference between an explosion and a detonation. Explosions are based on the speed of sound, and they're ordered. And detonation is actually chaotic and can be transonic. And so... they're trying to get detonation to work as far as being a propulsion system, and they couldn't keep it sustained because they would start a detonation, it would actually blow up the material they were trying to detonate. But they've got one that works for like 5 seconds, and if they can get this thing working in an engine, and God knows it might take them 10 or 20 years, they're talking Mach 17, like airplane to orbit stuff.
Why? Could you have humans on that? That would probably hurt. Kind of depends on the acceleration, I suppose.
Well, it doesn't. It's not zero to Mach. I hope it's not zero to Mach 17. But no, it's. it would be a. I would hope they. Yep, there's like a throttle in this thing. You know. Yeah. Oh yeah, they could probably detonate you to Mach 17. I'm not sure it'd be an enjoyable thing, and you could go to orbit as well. It would. The whole thing would work out.
I'm sure parts would.
Get parts. There's a story about a manhole cover that actually got launched into orbit from a nuclear disaster. You guys might want to Google that. It's pretty cool.
Manhole cover, yeah. You know, this device here, there was a sci-fi book I read 25 years ago or whatever where they used H-bombs to launch the spacecraft.
It's one of Bob's favorite things, the Orion. It was the Orion program, and there was the Inerva as well. They're going back to this nuclear rocket idea, and I'm not sure if we've got to do something different than chemicals if we're going to get a tool around the solar system.
Yeah. At a decent rate.
Yeah. It's weird because we sort of need sort of another SpaceX only like past Earth orbit. It'd be great to get to Mars in a week. Stuff like that would be really nice. And not only really nice, I think it's going to end up being necessary to do anything useful. Okay, so this was pretty cool to me. These guys, if you're not familiar with uncertainty principle, it basically says you can measure position or momentum, but not both, because the observation itself changes the particle. It's actually much deeper than that. The particle doesn't have both the position and momentum, which is really crazy. But somehow... these guys have managed to avoid this Heisenberg uncertainty principle by making tiny drums. And you can read the article if you're interested. Basically, what they've done is one drum reacts to the other. So while they could not measure one drum, because that would break the uncertainty principle, they can measure both. And by measuring both, they can actually determine the position and momentum of each drum. And that was pretty wild.
Yeah, so here's the anti-intuitive thing for me in that article was, if I have two things that are uncertain and I put them together, I'm going to expect more uncertainty, not less.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, it's a matrix. It's an imaginary, as I understand it, it's an imaginary number matrix of probability waves. And so the matrix begins to collapse the more of those you have. So in other words, just like a simultaneous equations, one may mean a whole bunch of uncertainty, but two, you actually start threading the two uncertainties together and you limit the number possible outcomes. So it's, the math works. I'm just not really sure how they're measuring little drums. Maybe they have little tiny monkeys playing the drums. I'm not sure how there's a little conga line of I don't know.
We got to make details. Yeah.
We did this the last couple of weeks. We keep running into this quantum uncertainty, is not enough theme where it's like, well, up to this point, we've told people this doesn't work, this works, and now it's like, well, wait a minute, maybe we can get around this a little ways. It's really cool.
Yeah.
Bears watching. Another physics story up next. This is a opinion essay, and basically a physicist who's changed his opinion about dark matter. Are you familiar with dark matter?
Well, I don't know any of the physics or any of the math, but certainly been reading about it for decades.
I don't know. I don't know the math either. I'm just I should repeat what I've heard. But the dark matter is, if I remember correctly, there was a famous woman astronomer who was measuring galaxies and the rotation in galaxies, and it did not conform to Newton or Einstein's idea of how fast they should rotate. So there was missing mass somewhere.
Yeah,
and that's dark matter. We've been trying to.
The rotational speeds were too high.
Yes.
And you're expecting the outer galaxies to be moving faster than the inner ones.
The outer stars around the galaxy should be moving faster. I think if I remember correctly, they were all moving at the same speed, which didn't make any sense at all.
Yeah, it was like, that didn't make sense either. I'm just wondering how to even envision that.
I learned a lot of
interesting stuff. A record player, you'd watch it spinning around and, the outer edge is going faster than the inner, but the inner one's doing more. Well, they're all doing the same RPMs.
The thing is, if you'll see a spiral galaxy, those spirals are not stars moving around like a record player. I thought that as well. Those are actually pressure waves. So it's like a, condensation like that, a pressure wave moving in a circle around. So the star movement and the movement of the spiral arms are actually different things.
That's interesting.
So this, it used to be, we couldn't figure out what it was, and there were two big theories, machos, which is little tiny things, and wimps, which are, maybe I may have them backwards.
Machos?
They were acronyms. Weakly interacting something particles is wimp, and I forget what macho is. They've been trying to do particles because, bless their hearts, particle physicists love particles. And this guy's just saying, 20 years, this particle thing, I'm thinking maybe the equations themselves need adjusting, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, it was this article, they're talking about, she looked at it from a particle perspective, like you said, because that's what she knew. And then other people looked at it from a different perspective, from the gravity perspective, and saw something different. And now here's for the big surprise down at the end is maybe it's both.
Yes.
And
when we don't know, we don't. Yeah. By definition, we don't know.
Yeah. But I thought that was really interesting. Her perspective, which was, here's what I know, and I'm going to fit that to it. And, you see this, in everyday work, right? I know how to do a for loop in C. So I go to Python and do that. And then somebody looks at it and goes, you don't know Python. It's like, well, of course I don't. But, then you have Tim Ottinger look at it and goes, oh, why didn't you use a generator? Yeah. So
my first real commercial job, I went from little Bumblebee, Virginia to California, big city. And I worked with one of the guys on the team. I think he was Turbo Pascal or it was some oddball thing. And whatever the problem, we could do this in Turbo Pascal. It was magic. Could do anything. It was just like he had first figured out that this one thing he had could be applied to anything, and it's.
Yeah.
So we all do that, I think. It's...
Absolutely.
Lunar trains.
Yeah, that was cool. It's a maglev on the moon. Yeah. You ever been on a maglev?
I have never. Have you?
Yeah, the Shanghai maglev.
Ooh.
It's quite a vehicle to go on. It goes 400 and something kilometers per hour.
Oh, my God. Wow.
It's just flying from the airport to nowhere, basically.
But you're going fast.
You're going fast.
Wow. Yeah, that's. I always wonder if those trains going that fast, if just a squirrel or a bird, I mean, they have to have some plan for.
The plan for a squirrel and a bird is they're going to get run over.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess there's a mass issue there, right? It's yeah. In a little plane, when you're going like 200-300 miles an hour, it's a little plane. You hit a buzzard, it's a bad thing. But in a train, yeah.
So this picture's cool. They've got the load going up this hill and over. And I was wondering, you know, what if, and they're like big and concerned about dust, right? You know, if they had a lunar rover, it'd be kicking up some dust. And, you know, that would disturb things if you're kicking up dust. So here's, you know, the environmental issue on the moon will be kicking up dust. Yes. So it's not kick up any dust. So you put it in a train, a maglev train.
If I remember correctly, dust on the moon, because there's no atmosphere, has not been eroded. So the dust are like little spiky pieces. It's very corrosive.
Hmm. Yeah. I was wondering about dust getting on top of this thing, but I was thinking, well, why would it? There's no wind.
One of the interesting things we're watching here, both with Mars and the moon, is this whole actual, I mean, real-world planning about how do we go there and stay. I mean, when we were kids and growing up, they talked about this all the time. But now it looks like maybe they're actually both talking about it and doing it.
Yeah. Well, we're late. 2001 Space Odyssey, you know, 1968.
Yeah.
The hell,
we're gonna get there. The monolith's gonna like falling over, be a bunch of graffiti on it. You know, Martians were here, you earthlings suck. It's gonna be like, oh, that's man, right. We took the gateway ahead of us,
absolutely.
So, the next one is more program related. This is the mortifying ordeal of pairing all day.
Yeah, this was interesting. And this
guy worked at one of the more famous consulting firms that does a lot of really cool XP programming work. He made the point that they didn't have to pair all the time, but they somehow did anyway.
He made it sound like that was the implied rule, was that thou shalt pair, which, you know, who could do that? I don't think... As you know, Kent, when we were learning extreme programming from him, CMMI was big back then too. And so somebody would say, Kent, what is CMMI? What's the CMMI level of XP? And he says, well, I don't know, but XP is level zero of this, you know, of this. These practices are level zero. You've got to go take them and then, you know, kind of make them your own. You know, so you start with, it's a starting point, you know, like Scrum was supposed to be a starting point where you would go and invent all these wonderful ways to solve problems and people just keep going through the motions. But XP, you know, was a starting point that you could evolve from it. And if pairing all the time hurts, well, Doc, if I had a hammer here, I'd start hitting myself in the head with it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm with you, James. I think it's interesting how quickly we move from, hey, this is a good idea. Try it. See what works, to this is what we will always do, and it is the way of us. We will, our tribe always does this.
Yeah.
It's like, no.
And then there's guys like Bob that write the three laws of TDD, which people take literally. I mean, you know, so yeah. I always have to add parentheses after them. Yes. Do not write any, I'm sorry, Bob, you're not here today. Do not write any production code unless there's a failing unit test, parentheses, if it makes sense in this case.
Yeah, I've got mixed feelings about you. All of my, you know, I have you, Bob, Tim, a bunch of friends of mine have written a lot of really cool stuff, and I try not to read too deeply into what my friends have written. Not because I don't appreciate you guys or you're so smart, because it's when you write something, you're kind of forced to take a stand on various things.
Yeah,
and you know, hey, time moves on. You know, it can your writing can make you look a lot more intransigent than you actually are.
Yeah. Yeah, so you froze a little bit during that. So, but I
sorry.
Yeah. Well, you know, all this stuff, we're supposed to be thinking. You know, so people do my first test-driven development exercise, and in the debrief, I'll get a concern that says, you know, I didn't like the fact that we weren't supposed to think. And then I have to look at them and say, let's see, can we replay the part of my talk and the materials that said don't think? Thinking is not optional. You're gonna, if I ask you to not think, would you actually stop?
I don't think so. I'm not sure.
Yeah, you're going to keep thinking, you know, so let's keep thinking. That's not part of it. It's what are you going to do next, right? You know, and so, but
if you haven't experienced a purgatory or some sort of infernal torture region, you should try training programmers because it is a lot of fun. Yeah, if you try to say do the best thing and think, they're like, well, this just doesn't have enough detail in it. The man's just waving his arms around. So then you go, okay, here's an example of doing the best thing. 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, that's too prescriptive. It's like,
that's too easy.
Yeah, it's too easy. You're being too prescriptive. It's like, well, gosh, I'm telling you the general principle, and now I'm giving you an applied example. I can give you all the other applied examples.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like, this is the job. We have to take general principles, critically think, and actually do stuff.
That's right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, you don't start off with derivatives of the most complicated equations. You start it with y equals x squared. What's it, you know, and then you build your way up from there, right? So you start individual pieces.
I have to confess, I love geometry. I actually took geometry as a summer school course as a new. I went through all my high school math in like 2 years because I just love math. So I did geometry for summer school because it was fun. And it was just a hoot. You just start with these like little, like two parallel lines, never cross, and a couple little things. And it just keeps folding on itself to become more and more complicated.
Yeah. You got to get started thinking that process. But we left this article now, and what struck you about it, Daniel?
What struck me is the thing I've sort of been working on for some time with the process side of what I'm doing, and that is we all talk about how to know when you're doing something too much. Because we over and over again come up with some good thing, goodness, TED or whatever, and we talk about the goodness and people like it and it works for them, but we never say, hey, wait a minute, there's actually some boundaries here to everything. I wouldn't use TDD in an academic format. I wouldn't use TDD to do SQL. You know, there are limits to everything, and we just don't seem to teach that very well.
Yeah, sure.
So, yeah, a little bit's good. A lot may not be so good.
Well, yeah, that's why I was picking on Bob's first law of TDD. It's like, if it makes sense. You know, so sometimes you might decide to have something really small and low complexity that is not worth testing so that some other thing can be kept independent of that thing. Usually this happens when you're near hardware or radio or a network connection or, you know, something where you have to break that dependency and go get back into the world of pure software. Where zombies rule, Daniel.
Zombies. Yeah, I'm with you. I think that I remember you guys when we did this F-sharp Follies with Clean Coders. It was frustrating for me because you guys were using zombies and some of the things. Hey, hi, my Fuzzy. using zombies and some of the. I'm trying to, if I stick my head close, will it, like.
Yeah, come on, camera. Fix.
I'll just keep going.
Okay.
We tried using different things that would actually sort of splay out or sort of discover the path through the various object graphs we're creating. Except for using functional programming, we're actually talking about ideally integer transforms and no types at all. And I learned so much by watching all the struggle with that. And I learned that your way of thinking of solving a problem can actually sort of affect the way you solve it in the end. So. Yeah, I don't bring zombies with me to my F-sharp programming. I would never ever leave them for my C-sharp or C or C++ programming, but for F-sharp or pure functional, no zombies for me.
No zombies, yeah.
No. I killed the zombies, dude.
All right, well, we'll have to go through that again. You'll show me why zombies don't help it.
Well, it's not test. I ATDD big time on functional code, but It is the same reason I will not test an SQL statement. I want to stick with vector transforms, and vector transforms by definition don't have a zombie. You're relating sets is all you're doing. You can say that that set relation doesn't give you what you want. That's fine. But you're not actually making a decision on those sets. You're just describing a relationship.
Yeah, okay. So zombies, zero, one, many, boundaries, interfaces, exceptional situations, keep it simple. There's thinking, though, about that, which would be, now you're going to start speaking clearly.
I have to sit farther back. It's not closer. I have to go back. That's it. Okay.
Okay. And now you're going to probably have more clear ideas as well?
Nah. Hey, well, slow down here. I thought we're just shooting this shit. We're not actually talking about where we're
working. Yeah, no. But, you know, so there's what are simple cases I can use to make sure that the thing I'm doing works is kind of a meta zombies, if you will. There isn't really a zero case, but what is the simplest case I can think of that I could actually look at and say it worked? You know, so if I was multiplying two vectors or something and, you know, one of them is filled with zeros, what would I expect the answer to be? You might, you know.
Well, see, here's the thing, my friend.
I don't know. So
I still do zombies, but I do zombies at the outside of microservices.
Yeah.
And I do them in a ATDD fashion where I'm actually accepting or not accepting what the microservice does. And then inside the microservice, I restrict any use of types, and I just use pure transforms. So I try to make the outside, all kinds of zombies wandering around there, and I try to make the inside just an SQL statement. That keeps it very simple for me and makes my code easier to understand.
All right.
I don't know if that makes sense or not. We should walk through it sometime.
Yeah, definitely.
So the next one here is...
Speaking of hearing, I don't get to do it enough, so...
To this guy's point, pairing can... You don't want to do... Maybe half a day, a couple, 3 days a week. You don't want to do 8 hours of pairing a day. Good God.
Yep.
I don't think I could do it.
It's intense. And I thought one of the important things he noticed there that he mentioned was you really like open yourself up, right? You know, so as in the beginning days of pairing, I remember the fear, and he used the word fear in there. The fear that a lot of people had of pairing is because, you know, now, architect sits down with junior programmer and junior programmer teaches architect something, right? Architect doesn't have instant recall on all the details. So, and we are kind of afraid of that perspective, right? There was some fear there that you have to reveal what you don't know in real time, which is more than you actually know.
You know, so. Yeah, it's weird that when I started coding, of course, this was before there was widespread programming. I came through school, I was really good in math, and so much of it was this sort of prima donna sort of, you know, I am the man sort of macho nerd. If you've seen Halt and Catch Fire, it's an excellent example of this in action. But yeah, so there's this individual thing where you have to show how good you are, how smart you are. But the more you learn about programming, the sort of the social nature of it, the biggest skill is just to say, beat the shit out of me. Can you show me something? Because I don't know, really. Help me out here.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
I tell people that talk about doing things too much and wrong. Stand-ups are always done god-awfully.
We'll get to that if you still have the same last article.
Yeah. And so stand-ups are just, hey, I need some help here. I don't understand this. And then we stop after we talk for a few minutes, and we know who doesn't understand stuff, and we go fix what they don't understand. We help them out. There's your stand-up. You just did one. This next article is near and dear to my heart because I woke up the first thing one morning. I forget what morning it was, but I'd had a couple of beers the night before. I wake up, I look at this article, and the title is, "There's No Such Thing as a Tree." And I'm like, I got to go back to bed. This day is going to be too long.
Yeah, this guy's...
Did you get a chance to read that one?
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting that trees, you know, the lineage, there isn't like a common ancestor to a tree, which is, I thought they were going to be talking about, you know, this computer construct of a tree, biology, which, you know, so I don't know anything about biology. But it was interesting that a maple actually, common ancestor of maple and mulberry tree is not a tree, which is kind of an interesting thing. So this diagram you got up there, that's kind of cool. I was poking around at that to see if there were some strange relationships in there, but I don't remember what I saw. But I like this one line. The confusing part is a tree evolving into a dandelion. Dandelions used to be trees.
Yeah, this is a, the reason I like this from a programming standpoint is that we're always trying to do data modeling or object modeling. We're trying to sort of model what the person's telling us in OO. And biologists, did, matter of fact, we get this from biology. So Aristotle said, hey, we'll sort these things up by how many legs they have, and how many ears they have, and all that. And so we came to biology doing this sort of top-down. This is a duck. This is a chicken. We define the rules top-down, and so we've been doing this for centuries. But now we have access to the genetic code, and we're going back and saying, oh, my God, actually, trees are an example of convergent evolution. These are different things that actually converge back together to look like a tree.
Yeah.
And so it's not that if you look at it from the outside, they all look like trees. But if you look at how they got that way, the journey is completely different for each of these things.
Mm-hmm. So if we took, you think about this from a software perspective, I'm looking at one of these lines here, is that the Canary Islands invented wood 38 times in the history of the Canary Islands, right? So an isolated place, a bunch of things morphed into trees, over countless years, right?
Yeah.
Now you go look at software and you see things reinvented, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so dependency inversion and other names, right? Programming to interfaces. Singers, the principles that
Gang of Four, yeah.
Names, right? You might rediscover all those.
And this is design patterns, Gang of Four. Wow, do we reinvent things over and over again? Jeez. Yeah.
I'll get something in it, somebody that's an embedded and show them. If you like, when I first saw TDD, it was demonstrated in Java. Now, if another embedded engineer that kind of wasn't ready for the problem that TDD was solving and saw that, they would say, well, what does this have to do with me? That's in Java. I'm an embedded systems engineer. That doesn't apply. For me at that point in my career, 20 years in, I had spent 20 years not having anywhere to run my code and like run it in a test harness. Oh, wow. What a great idea. I wish I would have thought of that.
You're kind of on the cutting edge of this, which is really cool. I was telling Melissa about this. We watched the SN15 SpaceX launch last week. And I work with a few embedded teams, and it's always been, you just can't do incremental development and embedded stuff because we're building our own boards here, and this is all very complicated. This is not like software. This is very, different and all this. And now Elon's going, okay, we're doing this with freaking rockets, all right? So the tide has changed now. It's like, okay, well, maybe we can use these XP things
Then Elon updates your car overnight while it's sitting in your garage, so who's
I'm glad to see that we're finally catching up with the embedded hardware folks, because we've needed to do this for, like you said, 20 years or more, and it's just taken so long for those guys to sort of pick up the thread here.
Well, I got to say, they don't realize how incremental they are, because if you go look at how hardware evolves, somebody has an idea, they put some parts together with some wires, they see if it works. They find out it doesn't work the way they thought. They fiddle around, they get their scope out, they add some resistors, and now it works. Tell me that's not incremental. Right? You had an idea, it was wrong, it was kind of right, and then you evolved it to something that worked. Right?
Part of this is the old silo problem, and we see this in software, but the hardware guys just haven't experienced it. I mean, yes, you're correct. There's the inventor guy who does that, but then immediately almost we separate the hardware and software guys. And so the software guys are taught, well, you wait for the hardware guys to finish, and then you start coding. It's like, no, you guys have to get together on this. These two have to go hand in hand.
Oh, yeah. Simultaneous. In the lead. I'll use a train.
I remember the first embedded team I did Agile XP coaching with, there was a couple guys who refused to catch the Nerf football. And it's like, I didn't really know what to do. I was like, okay, so... See, I'll give you guys a little inside tip. When I used to do agile coaching, or we'll just say A, I used to do A coaching. we do things like throw the Nerf ball, whatever. The simple reason, everybody can't talk at the same time. But the really Machiavellian reason is, are you guys like laid back and able to like solve problems, or is this going to be like a bunch of tight ass assholes? And so we had a guy who actually refused to catch the Nerf ball. It's like, I don't know what to do. So we would, the team would take the ball and set it down in front of his feet, and then he would do the stand-up, and then they would move it again. Like, oh, this is going to be a long time with these guys. This is the same guy. I told him, like, you know, we were doing embedded work, and, like, you know, there are ways to do incremental iterative embedded. You can stub things out. I can talk about various ways to pre-gen boards, and he was just like, nope, sorry, this is too high level for me. You're just sort of waving your hands around. Okay, fine. I hung back, and about 3 weeks in, one of the other engineers goes, you know, we could actually stub some of this out. And the guy said exactly the same thing I'd said 3 weeks ago. And the guy was like, yeah, maybe we could do that. Might actually work. And I'm like, it was just so we had to hear it from the correct person.
That's right. So usually, oftentimes the outsider will be that right person, but sometimes not. Right.
I as long as the team progresses, it's fine with me.
That's right. Yep. Absolutely. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Matter of fact, I'm doing my job when everybody says, why is he still here? So here's a Fowler genetics. If you're interested in this categorization stuff, and it talks about all the things we were just talking about. It's a fascinating topic. So speaking, and this takes us to the next categorization, which these are kind of go hand in hand. Have you ever done one of those, Briggs-Myers personality tests?
We went through something like that where they put you into quadrants, right?
Yes.
You would driver, depending on, you know, how you answer a bunch of questions. It was kind of amazing how accurate it was, but there's driver, amiable, analytical, and, you know, something else.
Yeah. So they've been modeling personalities for a long time. The Briggs-Myers actually was a mother and daughter put this together back in the teens, I think, 19-teens. And various amounts of success. Some people love the Briggs-Myers. Some people hate. There's a color chart for all kinds of ways to model personalities. And somebody thought about 10 or 15 years ago, instead of sort of coming top down, which is the same discussion with the trees, instead of this top down model, let's go through all the written literature about personalities and do a statistical text sampling of how you describe people's personalities and create the model around the words we use to talk about personalities. And they came with the Big Five. So they have the Big Five. Have you ever heard of the Big Five traits? This is the Big Five. And it's a bottom-up classification system.
What I liked about the Big Five traits is I wasn't surprised by them. Okay. Now, that's the across the top of your matrix.
Yes.
And then all the rest of it, I think, is total garbage.
Yeah. I agree with that. I don't know. But it's a cool little chart, though. Yeah, it's got different colors in it, and it's
Actually, the first one, I think they kind of got, you know, like, go back to the top of that again. So I think, like, life satisfaction, job satisfaction, you know, it's not surprising that those are the blue traits, which means, you know, you've got, you're somewhat extroverted, so you like to talk to people. You can agree, you don't have to have it always your way, right? And conscientiousness, right? It was interesting when they did analyze the presidents, most of the presidents were conscientious. Emotional stability, openness, those seem like if you, you know, had some maturity in all those areas, why wouldn't you have a fairly satisfactory life, right? Now, when they get down, they start doing some other crazy stuff with it, you know.
Yeah, schizophrenia, depression. This is wrong in a number of ways, but I think what tickled me the most was the whole purpose of the Big Five thing was, okay, let's stop trying to categorize from the outside in. Let's just figure out what the data is. So then they took this and did a matrix from the outside in again. It's like, shit, guys, this is what we were trying to get away from and begin with. Yeah. Oh, wow. Like ADHD. Right? So this is, we're still debating what exists. Is it ADD? There's each one of these you can debate ad infinitum for the same reason that the other model personality models didn't work.
I saw politically conservative in there, but I didn't see politically liberal.
And I was down. Down toward the red, yes.
Right? I wonder why. Maybe he didn't like the answer, the author.
I'm non-particle partisan, but Republicans should be down at the bottom here somewhere below gambling disorder. Always, I tell you, talk about bad science. I always like it when I read this study where it's obvious that the people doing the study were just sort of trying to find something to get a paper published on. It's always some sort of politics, like, you know, people who like squids vote for Nazis. It's some kind of ridiculous association. Like yeah, yep. Okay, that's a lot of good science there. Huh?
Okay, so you now you've got your jetpack.
Did you see? This is really freaking cool.
So did I get it right? You could like click on here and then you could join their simulator and you'll buy a package to learn how to fly a jetpack. And then when they become available, then you'll be able to go, you'll be all trained.
The Royal Marines are already testing these things to do shipboard boarding. So if you got to get on a ship quickly, they just put these things and fly over to the ship. Like, it's like something out of Star Wars. It's like Boba Fett coming down. That's cool.
Oh, man. But so is the suit like providing support there? It's like, are those arms?
You're doing like a when you're on the parallel bars, your arms are holding you up.
Yeah, but there must be a mechanical arm there too, because otherwise, you know, you turn on those rockets and you're going to break your arms off or something, right?
I don't know how the throttling works. I do know that you don't have a lot of time, just several minutes at most. So
yeah.
You want to get to that ship.
You're holding yourself on parallel bars for several minutes. You know, of course we could do, but enough to like fly you around. It's like,
I don't know. I tell you, if someone were to buy me one of these, I would figure this out somewhere. You would be seeing me flying around, right? Because this would happen.
I think so. There's going to be an exoskeleton associated with it.
Yeah, the exoskeleton thing is a kind of a nifty engineering problem because they wondered why you couldn't have wings, and you can't have wings because your sternum is not strong enough for wings. So exoskeletons work, but you have to be careful. It's a load balance. You have to figure out where the load's going to go, where it can't go. And
mm-hmm.
We happen to be quite well engineered over millennia of evolution such that it's not just, you just can't bolt a sort of a rocket on.
Did you catch the message of that one clip there? It was with one of these, you can fly circles around a Corvette.
Yeah, I really, this has got me going, ah, yeah, this is a chin on the ground, drooling. Good stuff.
There he is, flying circles around or maybe that was a Lamborghini. Nice. There he is.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I saw that. Yes. And somebody said that these are actually jets that were originally used in planes, or remote controlled airplanes. So these are like tiny jets they've used for years, and they just made them big enough they can carry people around.
You scroll to the bottom of that page, and the test pilots are the engineers.
Yeah.
if you click through and find out about me on that, you end up seeing the pictures of the guys. And, you know, two of the guys, they're 19, you know.
Oh, whoa. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's you talk about wanting your hardware and software to be working well. Yeah. It's one of the things you build, if you build small airplanes, experimental planes, either the ultralights or the gyrocopters, you have to do this thing where you built this thing to fly. Nobody else has ever flown in it. So you have to become one. You have to figure out how to make this thing fly that's never flown before.
Yeah.
And I was watching this show the other day about tiny, tiny, tiny planes. And this one guy actually took a full-sized, like a fighter plane jet, and just bolted wings on it, and you laid down on top of this thing. So he built this basically jet you lay on and pilot. And he said, you know, for some reason, it was hard for people to control. And then he had to build up this test harness about how to, you know, he had this thing, a pickup truck, he'd pull you behind. And without the test gear, you just couldn't fly. You could fly it for a bit, but then it was a cursed flat.
Yeah, well. Modern airplanes don't actually, they just take your input as advice on where the plane should go, I think.
That's a fly-by-wire, yeah.
Yeah. And you could kill yourself with the G-forces if, you know, in an F-16, right? So they've got to override. The computers are thinking about what you're trying to do and don't let you do it. Yeah, you don't know about it.
Yeah, I understand how, and you're right, an F-16, you could kill somebody very quickly with the kind of power you have on some of these things. Yeah. Back in my day, we had biplanes, son. Yeah. We had three engines on them, and you go where you want and you drop grenades on the bad people. But no, they don't have that anymore. Next one is another biology one. It's the Retrons, which are going to be the next version of. Have you been following the CRISPR story?
This is like a foreign language to me. So, Daniel, you're going to have to explain it. You're going to have to explain
it. I will bullshit, and if you don't know the difference, we're good at the end.
Well, my note here says, oh, there's some genetic scissors in here. I know what a scissors is. So that means you can slice this stuff up. And all right. So yeah,
that's the long and short of it. We could see the genes and not really do much except for breed to sort of change them. Then CRISPR came along. We can actually go in and change each little gene at a time. And now the Retrons are coming, which we can change a million genes at a time, which is going to be just as far out as CRISPR was. It's going to be really wild.
Yeah, so why would we know what million genes to change all at once?
Well, see, but this is why this is such a computer nerdy story, because now that you're going to have the ability to change millions at a time, you're going to have to create some sort of million matrix test gear that does all this sort of combinatorial testing on whatever your sample is to figure out what's working or not. It's going to be a major, major.
Right, so that would be of order million squared then, huh?
Yeah, that math again. It's not just a million squared. It could be a million factorial, depending on how you do the ordering. Yeah.
Ooh, so it's just a good idea. I don't, you know, okay, so it's cool. That they could make a million changes to a DNA strand all at once, but you know, programmers have a hard enough time just getting one instruction right. You know, so how are we going to get a million simultaneously right? It's just like,
well, yeah, I can just see sometime in the future their doctor coming out. Well, yeah, Mr. Grinning, we have we fixed your mother's cancer, but she does have an elephant nose now. It's unavoidable. Yeah, she can get peanuts a lot easier than before. It's a, yeah, I don't know how we're going to balance that kind of power. This, I mean, because millions at a time, we're talking about really you control the whole thing here.
Well, somebody will have to have a theory about what those, and I'm sure they're developing them, what particular genes are doing. And
we know this computational biology thing. We didn't think we could sequence genes 30 years ago. It's an insurmountable problem. And now you can get it done in $50 or something.
Yeah. Well, that was this is like 30 years ago. You weren't even talking about the sequence, right? And so now they're talking about editing it a million edits at a time. Pretty wild.
Yeah. I remember when I was coming up through high school and college, you could see the genes. We knew what the genes were. And we talked about them as being sort of the building blocks of life. But as far as getting down into the alleles and all the different things, nobody had really gotten that far, I don't think.
I wonder if there's like a regex kind of thing going on for these biologists to use. Mm-hmm. And then they do it, and all of a sudden, you know, they get this cow with a pig's head. It's like, oops, let's fix this a little bit. Oops, we got the wrong.
Your online gene regex tester, you know, where you get like a picture, like, and you type some like anything. I was like, oh, I guess I'll try it again. just what I need, more freaking regex in my life.
I'm trying to breed a cow that gives milkshakes right away. It's like, how do we... They got to be cold, too.
Regex is something I have no problem with, but my brain refuses to remember. So, like, I get in, I get to go to the online thing, I figure it out in an hour or two. This is cool. I remember all this stuff. I remember capture groups and all that. I go away, and then I don't use it for 6 months and come back. It's like, what the hell is it? And then I got to go back to the same thing again.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, you don't want it.
Yeah. In it. All right, let's see.
So the next one is the article essays titled "The One Where Writing Books Is Not a Really Good Idea." So since we've both written books, do you have any sort of commentary on it? Because this like put me in full rant mode, actually.
Yeah, you had mentioned that in the notes. I didn't go look at your rant. Too bad I didn't. That would have.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
I think, you know, is this person's trying to see as a novel writer, you know, how to make money. Now, you know, as a technology person, you don't write a book to make money. You write it to get an idea out there, right? And maybe you get some follow-on consulting business.
Yeah, and this sort of so, hones in with the sort of categorization top-down, bottom-up thing, because what this guy's saying is, well, of course, you're only writing to make money. And since you're only writing to make money, then it's going to be a failure. So my whole essay kind of boils down to, first, make sure that you're why you're writing, because they're, you know, you may not be writing for money, that's fine. And secondly, there are trade-offs to whatever you want to do in life, and just be aware of the trade-offs.
Yeah. I think the guy had concluded at the end, though, that if he could get into the Amazon deliver a book one chapter at a time routine,
yes,
right? You know, where the author actually gets 50% of the royalties, and then Amazon takes the other 50. Then you could probably, if you had 100 people in the world or 1,000 people that actually liked what you had to write about, that you could probably build yourself a sustaining income on that model.
You can. So I'm trying to hold back from ranting again, but here's the problem. Okay, once you start looking at the revenue model, you're no longer looking at the art form itself.
Yeah.
So I'll give you an example. I first started reading this serialized book, I don't know, back when Amazon Publishing first came out, and it's about this guy, it was a zombie world or whatever, but it was serialized. So I read the first chapter. Hey, cool. It's like a buck. Read the second chapter. And it was kind of cool for like six chapters. Then I realized this author had no freaking idea at all where he was going. He was just writing chapter after chapter to get paid.
Oh.
I was like, oh, you know, yeah, all right. It's not going to work. No.
All right. So I say, okay, so Daniel, your perspective, you're going to write because you've got something you want to say. And if somebody happens to give me some money for it, okay, that'll be a nice bonus. But I want to get the thing that's up here out.
Well, it's interesting because I've evolved, you know, I've been writing my entire life. I got paid for my first article when I was 16, so I've been writing. I am a writer. Matter of fact, I consider myself a writer above everything else. But I have evolved the way I do long-form books such that now what I do is I take a topic, something, a question that's bothering me, I gel on it for a while, then I write this big honking essay on it, and I publish it. I don't care whether people read it or not. I'm fine, right? And I do the next one. And then over a period of years, I may end up with 20 of these all around a central topic where I've written to reach sort of a conclusion and that they should string together to make sense. And at that point, I have a book. And so I write as sort of a year-over-year way of organizing all the stuff I'm assembling such that it all makes sense to me or the average reader. Not that I want to get, I can't do the getting paid thing because I'm, be honest, once I start focusing on that, I'm as bad as that guy writing the zombie thing. It doesn't work for me.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, so Ron Jeffries would say, you know, for me to figure out what I think about something, I've got to write about it. Right? So there's a discipline there. There's an activity of getting your ideas clear enough that you can express them so that somebody else can understand them as part of really understanding the idea. Which I agree with that. Yeah,
it's very similar to programming. You know, you and I can talk about programming sort of abstract and say whatever we want, and it sounds good. This is a human person-to-person conversation, but once we start putting that on paper and making sure that this piece lines up with that piece or this piece of code, you know, functions with that piece, well, that's a whole different thing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's another level. That's actually becoming rigorous at that point, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I get perfection, guys. If I were a fiction writer now, I think I would probably work on plotting, as far as plotting a multi-novel series. And once I got really good at plotting, then I would try to serialize, like this guy says. But that's a tough business to try to get in and immediately make money on. But I have a get rich writing poster right here. See?
All right.
Just, you program some here on the left. And then you deploy the monitor with gun feature, and then people will send you money.
I think you're going to have a related topic coming up here.
It's interesting how they all come.
With North Carolina.
I do. This one shows me these pictures. Well, I thought I had some cool. Yeah. Concerned parent, if all your friends jumped off a bridge, would you jump off? Would you follow them? And the machine learning algorithm says yes. And the point of that is that if we're focusing directly on the money, what we end up doing is sort of feeding the internet algorithms.
Yeah, but at any rate, you know, as a teenager, we used to go to the Racine Rock Quarries in southern Wisconsin, which basically you went there to go jump off cliffs. And so there wasn't a bridge, otherwise we would have gone and jumped off a bridge. But we liked to go, we liked swimming, and there were these 35-foot cliffs that we'd, you know, climb up in the tree on the 35-foot cliff and dive into the water. So, and your friends did it, so you had to do it too.
Oh, so you're saying, yeah, okay.
Well, of course the AI, if it's actually, you know, well, it would be a teenage level AI, I guess.
Yeah, it's the old saying, I want to be different and unique, just like everybody else.
Absolutely, yeah.
So this next one is the XY problem, and this is something we run into tech all the time. Anybody goes to Stack Overflow, you've got a problem with X, and you feel like you have to do Y to get X working. So then you can't get Y working. You go online and ask about, hey, anybody know how to do Y? And everybody's going like, why in the hell would you want to do Y like that? So you're actually asking about the wrong problem.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think, you know, as an engineer, and this is, I think, where people get stories wrong. You've got to do what the customer asked you to do. No, you don't. What you need to do is understand what the customer needs. So somebody says, I need, you know, blah, 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 blah. I need Y, okay, to use your XY problem article. I need Y. And so I might say, well, what problem are you trying to solve? That Y is going to help you solve that. And then you hear about the problem, and then you might have a different solution.
I want to know your problem, and then we'll make the machine solve your problem. I don't want to know what your problem machine is, because God knows what you know.
Yeah, your problem isn't Y. Your problem is something else. You're asking for Y, because that's the thing you can see. I remember my brother's company, the guy who gets the reports, that has to analyze the reports for their customer system, would say, can these reports be run every night? And it's like, okay, they probably could be run every night. And then, but why do you want them run every night? Because it takes 5 minutes to generate the report. Oh, what if we could just make the report run faster? Oh, yeah, that would be great. I could just get it when I wanted. Okay, you know, so we're about to contract for, I'm not sure which would be easier. It'd be nice to, you know, maybe the run it every night is the right answer, but it wasn't communicating to, you know, the development team what the problem was.
Yeah, I've seen you answer some questions on Core. I've looked at Core a few times. I never joined because it seemed like people were asking these sort of like, what is the best kind of chocolate? These sort of open-ended questions that just needed a lot more definition. And people would jump in and give them some sort of answer. And then, to your point, you need to have some kind of interaction to figure out why they actually want this thing, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, if the questions are asked, kind of specifically, you know, about something that I might know something about, then I don't mind answering it. But I know when I was first learning Ruby on Rails, which is what my website's built out of, Dave Rooney, our mutual friend, he put version 0.1 together. And that was when he started consulting, and then he got a regular consulting gig. And so I didn't have access to him when he said, here's your website, have fun. He didn't say exactly that. He said, I'll help you, you know, but I'm going to be kind of busy with my gig now. And so I would spend all day just on a problem. And I wanted to be able to ask the question in an intelligent way. And I didn't know the lingo. So it was like so hard to ask a question. It'd take me all day. And I'd finally, at about 4 o'clock, I'd send Dave a question. And then by the time I'd formulated the question, it's like, huh, maybe I'll just put that into Google and see what happens. And so, I don't know, Dave, how many times did this happen? But I would send that email, and then 5 minutes later, go, oh, never mind, I found the answer. Right? You know, so this ability to be clear about what your problem is you're trying to solve, and then be able to ask it in the lingo. I mean, go to a Linux forum and don't ask a question with the right lingo. No one will ever answer you. Those guys are the worst. You got to ask it. You got to ask a question really well.
It amazes me. Programming has become a meta skill. So we came up, we do hands-on hardcore programming for sure. But because there's so many different technologies and platforms and stacks and all this, it's the meta skill of saying, what is, like you said, what is the right question to ask, right? Or where do I find the logs for this? You're having to sort of deconstruct whatever is the architecture put together that you're actually trying to code to figure out what to actually do correctly, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, how do you get there, right? Yeah, I definitely related to this article.
And the thing that tickles me is that I heard the XY problem in the reverse sense. And that would be, you would know you had a technical problem, like I need to add X and Y. And so you'd go, hey, how in Pascal do we add X and Y? And people online would say, well, really, you don't ever want to add X and Y. What you want? And they would provide you a different answer, what you should have been asking.
Yeah.
Assuming, I guess, that you were having the similar problem that they were having. And you're like, no, I want to know X and Y. Now you tell me. So it's fun times.
Yeah.
Next story is the FBI goes, I think it's a place in California. They had some criminals that had used a safe deposit box or two. And so the FBI comes in and seizes all of the safe deposit boxes. And now if you want the stuff in your box, you're supposed to go and tell them what's in the box. And then they'll give it to you. And I try not to use profanity, but hell no. I'm not going to go to my local law enforcement and tell them what's in my safe in order to give it back to me. That's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
And so what tickles me about this is how much...
What do you have in your safe? What are you hiding?
You don't have it in my safe? I've got like 80 laminated pages of like birth certificate because I bought this laminator. And so all of our documents are laminated in the safe.
All right.
So that's what... But what tickles me about this in technology is if you go back and look at the first wiretap, was with illegally. It was done to, I think, the local sheriff, maybe the FBI at the time. I forget what their name was. But they were interested in a criminal, so they said, hey, this guy's got a phone. We'll just plug in and listen to what he's saying. And technology seems to be this situation where everybody involved just keeps pushing as hard as they can, and it takes us decades to kind of roll this stuff back.
Yeah.
That was the only rant there. I'm not going to go off on big government or...
This kind of made me mad that people do this. It also makes me kind of happy that I don't have anything in the safety deposit box that I own. But
do you have a safety deposit box?
I have one. My bank gives me one, and I used to have something in it, and then it went somewhere else. And I still have the keys in Illinois. I'm in Florida now, but I'm thinking I could transfer my empty safety deposit box to Florida now. So... Then I might put something in it down here. I don't know. But
yeah, I bought one of those little home safes. And like I said, it's just if you ever want to break in my house, I think I've got a diary from 1980, a bunch of laminated family papers. That's all
you're going to get. Okay. Yeah.
Next story. Oh, my goodness. Talk about the criminals and cops.
Oh, this made me mad.
Wow. This was amazing. Amazon fake review scam exposed in data breach. So we were used to people saying that reviews are fake online. This is a whole nother level of they found 13 million messages, more than 200,000 people engaged in unethical activities. This is a business. This isn't like criminals. This is a worldwide business.
Yep. And so the only silver lining in this story is that the 13 million people are the, what was it, hundreds of thousands of people providing this illegal service where they would write a review and then through a back channel go to the vendor and get a PayPal so they get their product for free by doing this so they could be verified by Amazon, right? It was really kind of an amazing scam, but now all their private data associated with it has been revealed. So,
That's what we have, really. Somebody said that all they're going to do is Amazon will give them like a 1 week suspension that these people are still going to be on. They'll just find a different channel. The really sad thing here, and I'm not trying to be cynical, but this is just the way it is that this benefits Amazon. This benefits the sellers. This generates more and more sales because the more social proof you see that people are buying your little widget, the more likely you are to buy it.
Yeah. Well, as much as this, dishonest, illegal stuff happens, it's going to keep happening.
It's going to keep happening.
Yeah, unfortunately.
One of the things I've noticed in the last 5 or 6 years is I'll go buy something that's like a $2 thing on Amazon, like a screw. It'll have like 40 reviews. This is the best screw. And it's like, come on. Nobody in their right mind is going to go online and like six paragraphs on a screw. And it's like, yeah, it's just not happening. No. So, yeah, I think we're going to end up with some sort of I guess, client-side fraud protection. I'm not really sure how it's going to work, but I'm looking forward to seeing somebody put some stuff together on that lines.
Okay, so maybe the outcome of this is that all the 5-star reviews are all fake and all the 1-star reviews are real?
Well, you know, the thing is, and I've been, this has been my unpopular thing to say when this comes up. You'll make more money in a small market by trashing your competitor than you ever will by telling people how awesome you are. And so, yeah, if there's only 5 people selling what you're selling and you're unethical, first thing you should be doing is paying somebody to give those guys 1-star reviews. Yeah, not fun. Sticking with criminals, this is the crap I've been living through. I had to, day before yesterday, I got up and my wife, Melissa, said, you need to go to the store sometime today and get gasoline. There is a gasoline crisis in your state. So I'm eating breakfast, and at lunchtime, I understand the North Carolina governor declares a state of emergency. The Virginia governor declares a state of emergency. I'm thinking, hell, there's a bunch of idiots out there getting gas. I need to get out there and get gas before these other idiots come out there. And so, like a good husband, I go to the store, and yeah, there's like lines in the street. It was chaos. I had to run over a couple grandmothers just to get. I got filled up. All they had was Supreme. The reason why was these hackers called the Dark Side Bunch, I guess, hacked into the Colonial Pipeline IT system. And because their IT system was hacked, they, in a preponderance of caution, they decided to shut down the pipeline as well. So then, golly, we have no gasoline. And not only is this like, oh my God, you're hitting our gas pump, it's also the hackers apologized, which is like, what? I got to read this. This amazes me. Hang on a second.
Yeah, we only wanted to steal money. We're sorry. Yeah. We're sorry that we shut down the gas supply for
We are apolitical. We do not participate in geopolitics. Do not need to tie us with a defined government and look for our other motives. So,
Put us with the terrorists.
Our goal is to make money and not creating problems for society. But yeah, we're happy holding up like the D.C. Police Department threatening to release their informants, which we talked about last week. But we're not going for your gas pump because they know this keeps screwing around with the gas pump. Somebody is going to become very kinetic on their ass. It's not going to go well.
Well, and if they view this as, you know, so now the terrorists have this idea, hey, we can go hack into these things and shut down the gas supply for, the East Coast of the United States. Let's go do that. Now, they don't want to be associated with terrorism because that's probably a much more severe penalty than just being a hacker trying to steal money. And extortion is probably not as bad as terrorism, right?
I don't know. I guess not.
Well, I mean,
I guess, from the viewer, the citizen standpoint, I guess Butch Cassidy's Sundance Kid were robbers, but they never shot anybody. There's an argument to be made that it's us against the man. But yeah, you start taking people's gas from them. That's no good.
And by the way, I wasn't condoning it. I'm just.
No, I know, but it's a different level of badness.
Yeah, these. These thieves, please, we're only thieves. We're not terrorists.
No, but the thing is that they're able to send, like, they're able to communicate back. Like, yes, we did this, but we're sorry. Oopsie. Our bad. Okay.
Did that come over Facebook or Twitter?
Somewhere on the dark net, I don't want to know. The infrastructure system, as you know, is so freaking brittle to begin with. I'm surprised that the credit card system actually works at all. It amazes me.
I'm surprised anything works, especially the call we're having here today.
We're getting better. Every time we get better. We got 2 more to go. The importance of humility in software development. This was a most awesome thing. I think you tweeted about this earlier today.
Good, yeah.
And this how do you pronounce his name? Do you know?
That's your Dykstra?
I think so.
Yeah, that's good extra.
This is like he had 3 points, and his 3rd point was approaching the task of software development as humble programmers. This was a presentation done when he received the Turing Award in 1972.
As a side note, I'm hoping that the geneticists have some humility while they're doing their work.
Yeah, because mama don't want no elephant nose. Yeah, because, that's...
Yeah, so let's 3 points, right? The use of abstraction to make programs intellectually manageable, right? So you have to have collect ideas into things that we could talk to and refer to kind of big. Correctness proofs, which is kind of interesting. I kind of used Dijkstra, one of his quotes, programmers should stop, not waste their time debugging. They shouldn't introduce bugs to start with. And, but how do we do that? Right. And so correctness proofs is what Dijkstra had in mind. Now, I kind of look at test driven as an approximation of a proof, kind of
Yes.
like Newton's method for calculating the area under a
Yes.
curve.
I can, that's a wonderful, that's yes, wonderful metaphor.
Yeah, and it led to calculus, but okay, it was a useful technique while we were figuring out calculus.
Yeah, this is the I think we were talking about this last week. To me, TDD not only helps you write better code, but really it's a language game. So you once you start writing the tests in the same language you're writing the code in, you realize you've forgotten all these things. That's why the TDD is called test-driven design by
Yeah.
many people, because what you're really doing is you're using the logic system, the computer, to tell you that you didn't think through writing the code correctly. That's cool stuff. And then if you're interested in the discussion, which I found the discussion is as interesting as the article, Hacker News has got a they've got like 200 or 300 comments. It's all about tribalism and how it's so easy for us to learn one language, like we talked about earlier, and think we know everything. And it's very common in our industry to overestimate, what we know, as opposed to just saying, "I don't know, help me out here."
Did anybody hop into Hacker News and say, yeah, except for me, because I know everything?
No, they
Didn't?
were all thinking that. So that's why I only had 200 comments. The other 200,000 people were going, "Well, these guys are just,
God, these are the dumb shits of our. These are
Yeah."
the ones that don't have the ability to have it all right all the time.
I remember I was talking to this one guy, CEO of a big company. I think he had a couple hundred teams, and I was saying, "Look, you've got some problems with these teams here. They're just not working correctly, and there's some issues. You're not giving them requirements." I went through the people problems that they were having. They're smart guys, right? And here's the people problems. And he kind of looked back and listened for a while. I said, "We got to get some smarter guys in there." And so what he was saying was, "I want people who will be really smart and lie to me, because then I can't figure out the problem anymore. If you bring to me like a people problem, which it happens to be my freaking job to begin with, then you're giving me work to do. But if I brought these smart guys, they're never ever going to tell me stuff I got to do." It was like, yeah, we should get more smarter. That's good. Why didn't I think of that? Dude, it's amazing. Oh yeah, so the last one.
But there was one quote in there. The competent programmer is fully aware of his strictly li of the strictly limited size of his skull, and therefore approaches programming with humility. And that was a great quote.
Yeah, programming should be telling you not how awesome you are. Programming should be telling you how broken you are, because you should be constantly challenged to write your code in a way that helps you correct your errors, not make you feel like you're king of the world.
Yeah, no doubt. Unless,
So
of
this,
course, you can take over a whole oil system.
well, yeah, but that's not what you meant to do. So hold up the local. If you want to hold the local bank, that's fine, as long as you're humble doing it. That's the important
Yes, okay.
thing.
And they were kind
Now,
of, oh, we didn't really mean to shut down the whole East Coast. We made
yeah, that one service station we hated, that's fine, but the whole East Coast, no, we're nice people. I don't understand the morals behind this whole hacker thing. I know they're trying to make some sort of point about not hurting people, but I don't get it.
We're only thieves.
I find that once you start making money from some endeavor, you tend to feel as if you're sort of the hero in the story, and you're doing whatever you're doing for good reasons.
Yeah.
This last one, this blew my mind almost as much as the detonation at the first one. This is, did you get a chance to look at this one?
I did, and but right away I had to go relook up convolution, which says chaotic process at blah 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 blah. And
So I'll give you sort of the 10,000 foot view. Grand Theft Auto and other games create these 3D models that they then sort of ray trace or do different things to show you a picture of what you're doing in the game, right? And these pictures have gotten more and more realistic, and If you can see here, there. So on the left, we've got the, here's the Grand Theft Auto, and they've got little pox in the pavement and all this kind of stuff going on. Well, the problem is that in some ways, they almost look hyper-realistic. They're just, they do so much to try to make it, see the little gravels and all that. They do so much to try to make it look real, it doesn't actually look real anymore.
Yeah, because the human eye wouldn't actually see it this way, right? Right. Yeah.
And so what these guys did, and this is amazing, they built this blended AI sort of model that goes through, pulls out the objects that the game is using, if you have a set of objects, you don't have to have one, combines it with what it thinks the objects are, and then combines that with actual pictures of the place you're at. Blends them all together.
Pictures of similar stuff, right?
Are pictures of similar stuff. Blends them all together, and you get something that looks much more like it was a picture taken on this street instead of a game.
Well, not like a picture as much as your mind's eye, what it would see.
See, this gets back to AI just being a big sort of fake head fake thing. This gives you something that you would think that you were looking at directly instead of something it looks like it was
sort of created. Yes, it's kind of interesting because the lines on the cars, you know, the real object of this thing, those are pretty good. But if you go look at any of the other little details, they've all kind of been smudged. Right? If you go look at the trees in the background, you can see the leaves in the real picture, but when you run the filter over it, it's all kind of smudged. But you know, so if you're paying attention to the subject of this, you know, the point of this frame here, it looks great, and everything else, you know, kind of is out of focus a little bit.
This amazes me. So here's the one on the left. We've got all this looks. This is the game.
Yeah,
and then here on the right we've got the processed image.
Yeah, that was really cool. When I discovered what that slider was all about, then it was even more cool to play with this.
Well, you learn these counterintuitive things. For instance, you can add noise to an image to make it appear sharper, even though it's not sharper. So you see a lot of this little grit in the road or whatever. What they've done is they've added noise, basically, to make it appear to you as if it's more photorealistic. But what you were just saying is that's not actually the way your eye processes the scene. Where I see this headed, and this blows my mind, we're going to end up with some sort of goggles or glasses you wear that does a connect or LiDAR view of the area around you, identifies the types of objects in this area, like a light or camera or whatever, and then it's going to run through something like this. It's going to actually create what it looks like. So you'll be able to walk around in the dark, in the fog, in the clouds, and you'll constantly be receiving this sort of head fake, looks like this is what it should appear to you stuff. And for most cases, I don't think you'll be able to tell the difference. it's insane. In fact, when I first saw this, I thought the process stuff was on the left because it had a lot more noise and detail, like you said, the leaves, whatever. But no, that's not what they're doing. They're saying that, you know, we're actually over-processing these images and the game's trying to make them appear more real, but that's not the way the actual thing looks if you're there.
Yeah, look at that palm tree at the top of that picture. Just,
yeah,
you know, it goes from blurry to sharp.
I don't know if you saw the end of this, was they've done this type of thing before. This is something they've been working for some time, but the problem before is it's not temporally stable. So the computer will figure out the objects, and then as the movie or game progresses, it identifies different objects. And so it causes the sort of system to keep jumping around. I don't know if it's got that or not, but it's not a pleasant experience the old way it's done. This actually remembers that's a motorcycle from frame to frame.
Yeah, I think the thing that you were showing with the disturbances and such in the background, right? There's a video you could watch with this too.
Yes.
And show you some of the other less successful attempts at this, I think. Right.
Yeah, it's at the top, maybe. Yeah. So if you go there, look at this one. I guess this is the.
Yeah, it's probably in that video right there. Yeah.
In this work, we are enhancing photorealism enhancement.
Okay, yeah.
We'll leave that as an extra for my watchers.
Yeah.
This is for you people at work.
So I guess that's about it. James, do you have anything you want to add? You been doing anything, consume any books or materials this week? Or
No, none of that. I don't know. I've got a list of things I need to do, which, of course, I haven't been doing. Actually, I fixed one of them, my OBS problem. So, but actually, I don't know why I fixed it. So it might be broken next time.
No. You fixed it. It was very difficult to fix, but you got it done.
Oh, yeah. Right.
I have been watching Halt and Catch Fire second time through. I loved it the first time. Second time's even better. It's about developing technology in the 80s and 90s. Internet, bulletin boards, personal computers, all that stuff is in there. If you're interested.
What's it called? Stuff.
Halt and Catch Fire.
Halt and Catch Fire.
Yeah, excellent show. I don't usually watch shows the second time because we have so many, but I told my wife, we got to watch this again because you'll love this. It's really good stuff.
Oh, cool. I've been looking, been wanting to find something to watch. There's so many options on TV and they are so bad. Oh, look at, no, now you're going to tie back in the nose.
Sorry. I have this bag of animal noses, as of course I'm sure everybody does at home.
I have captured and tamed the coronavirus.
Ooh, cool. Is that a bouncy where you bounce it and it starts flashing? Or?
Oh, come on. Don't spoil my fun. Oh,
I'm sorry. I didn't know.
It's all right. And then there's also a hole in the universe here.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so.
That's cool.
Toy.
Have you seen the things you spin with your hands that you keep? I'll have to show that next time. It's cool stuff, too.
Oh, the spinners. Yeah, I've got one here somewhere.
Hang on one second. I'll say goodbye to everybody.
All right.
Okay, you have completely wasted yet another hour with the nerds this week. We have had fun talking about nerd stuff. And you should be having fun with your own teams. Please let us know what you'd like to talk about if we're missing something that you thought was cool. And I'm Daniel Markham. This is where I am. I will see you on the internet.